Hi, I'm Ingo from Roast Rebels, and today we have a very special guest. He's a very experienced roaster, green coffee trader, quality specialist, a researcher, educator, and he's also a writer. And he has written a book on green coffee, which is, in my opinion, one of the best books about green coffee around, and the book that absolutely anybody who's working with green coffee must have read. And the person I'm talking about is Chris Corman. Hello, Chris. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Ingo. Thanks. It's very generous compliments. I appreciate it. Nice to be here.
So I'm going to ask you some questions on green coffee once I have you in front of my computer. But before we start with that, maybe you can introduce yourself on what's your background, who you are, and then also what led to the decision to write this book, and also a bit like what is your background that has been going into the book.
Sure. So I started my career in coffee while I was still studying at the university, and I learned to pour latte art and to pay for books, basically. And after moving to Chicago, I got a job with Intelligentsia in 2006. And that's kind of where I think the hobby became more of a career for me. And so I worked for them for 10 years. I started as a barista trainer and I worked in the quality lab as an assistant. I was a production roaster for about 5 or 6 years. And during that time, I got the opportunity to travel and begin purchasing. So I began buying coffee starting in around 2010, I believe, starting in Brazil and then eventually making my way to East Africa. So those would be the areas that I consider myself a specialist in. After a while, I moved out of production roasting and was the director of the quality control program for that company for about 3 years, working with Jeff Watts, basically, to make all the approvals. And then I was offered an opportunity to move to the San Francisco Bay Area, to Oakland, California, to join Royal Coffee. It's a green coffee importer. I've been working for them for the past 6 years as a educator primarily, but also as a quality specialist, continue to buy coffee, and took the opportunity to start putting pen to paper and writing some thoughts down about, you know, where my career had taken me. And I feel like part of my job, part of my mission in life maybe, is to kind of share the knowledge that I've acquired. And I felt like I saw a gap in information for roasters specifically and buyers who, you know, there's some great books on roasting out there, and I didn't want to wade into that particular stream. I felt like I had something to offer that was more interesting and relevant to people who had been, you know, working in quality labs or who were working on roasters and understood where the coffee was going, but maybe didn't understand as well about where it was from and what that meant for the product that they were using. And you know, I guess in a lot of ways, it's the manual that I wish I'd had when I first started working as a roaster, whether it was a sample roaster on small scale or as a production roaster on those 90 kg, you know, cast iron machines that I spent most of my day in front of for close to 5 years. There was this idea that I could provide something that wasn't there. So that's the motivation behind the book, I suppose.
Nice. So you made a book of about 170 pages on green coffee. Could you quickly outline what is the information or what is the content of the book? So what can people expect when they want to read the book?
Sure. I tried to be fairly broad in scope and fairly, accessible in terms of language. I wanted to make something that a person who didn't necessarily know the industry super well would be able to pick up and take something away from. But I also wanted to be very specific for people who are working as roasters and green coffee buyers to provide something meaningful to them. So there's a little bit about history and a little bit about, you know, how we get coffee from the fruit, from the tree. So there's a little bit about farm management and processing. There's a good bit of focus on trade practices, whether it's direct or from an importer, how to give meaningful feedback, how to make, you know, good quality decisions. And then a big chunk of the center of the book is about what I'd consider like the four pillars of physical analysis of green coffee: moisture, density, screen size, and physical defect count, and really trying to unpack not just what exactly those are, but also what they mean for roasters, how you can make informed decisions by making a couple of simple measurements. And then there's, you know, a little bit about storage practices and decaffeination at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, I just read the whole book, and I have to say the mission that you had, or the goals that you set yourself, are really, you really met them. It's very, I mean, there's a lot of information in it. It's very specific. Sometimes it's also technical, but it's really easy to understand for anybody who's interested in the topic. And it also gives some clear recommendation also when it comes to roasting, storing the green coffee. And yeah. So thank you. Thank you for having written this book. And now I want to take the opportunity to just go into some topics. And of course, you can have a look at the book with different views. Mine's that of a roaster. So I'm trying to get some information that are kind of, you know, like practical for me as a roaster, and that wants to create his cup of coffee. And therefore, if you can kind of break down when it comes to green coffee, what are kind of the most important things to have a look at on green coffee when it comes to finding a particular taste you want to create in your cup?
Sure. I think that probably the most important factor is processing type. Whether it's a washed coffee or a natural, for instance, is usually going to have a pretty significant impact. Mm-hmm. You know, certain choices that are made during processing. I think, you know, the roaster's choice, in a lot of ways, I feel like these are two sides of a very, you know, the same coin, where you've got the processor, the farmer who's, you know, harnessing the power of fermentation and the techniques that they use, and then the roaster who's harnessing the power of their machines and their equipment. And so by bringing those two things together, there's a lot of power to manipulate flavor on both sides of that equation. Mm-hmm. And then everything beyond that is kind of an influence, but maybe not a primary influence. So you have things like the origin of the coffee and the plant type, things like elevation and nutrition, but really it's a lot about the processor, I think, that creates these flavor opportunities that then the roaster has the opportunity to realize, to expand upon.
So can we go a bit into processing? Because I mean, at the end, it sounds very simple. We have naturals, we have washed, we have honey coffees. So what are kind of, are there some more nuances probably, or what is it that you can influence, or what tastes are coming out of different processing types?
Sure. I think it's an interesting time because scientists have taken a real interest in the process and are beginning to uncover some of the like chemical and microbial truths that we've been maybe assuming for many generations. And then also you see a lot of processors making innovations in terms of their choices at the farm level. So there's quite a bit going on. It's really, I would consider it kind of a renaissance for the processor at the moment. And even, you know, traditional methods like natural or washed have a lot of nuance to them. If someone tells you that they're producing a natural coffee, that's impacted, you know, so much by how the coffee is dried and, you know, how it's taken care of and, you know, whether or not there's a flotation step. So there's quite a bit that I think goes into it behind the scenes. And it's hard to understand that without frankly traveling to see it in person. And for me, you know, I understood that water was used to create washed coffees. And I understood that there was a step that removed the fruit from the seed before it was dried, but I didn't really understand the exact technical nuance of the step-by-step process that it took to depulp and ferment and then channel grade, and the many other potential steps that the producer can take to influence both quality and efficiency during that process until having observed it, you know, multiple times, and hoped to have communicated that clearly in the book. But it is a kind of a big whole world unto itself that the roaster barely gets the opportunity to observe and to touch, you know.
But I wasn't really aware of before having read your book is how different the methods can be when it comes to washed coffee. I thought like washed coffee, well, we're talking about washed coffee, but then like the step where the fermentation is happening, how it's happening, and everything can be quite, so there can be quite some differences than when it comes to washed coffee.
It's super interesting because I think that for such a long time, the fermentation step where we allow, you know, bacteria and yeast to help us remove the fruit from the coffee seed was you know, boiled down to functionality. It was like, let's use the power of nature to help us get the product that we want at the end. And there wasn't really a whole lot of regard to like what types of bacteria or yeast might be involved or what the impact might be of letting that fermentation go a little longer or a little shorter, or what, you know, are the possibilities in terms of flavor by creating a low oxygen environment by sealing the tank as opposed to letting it ferment traditionally in sort of open air. You know, do we ferment underwater? Do we limit the population of bacteria to some way affect the flavor profile? And that's really that, all that kind of advancement I think is taking place within the last 10 years. And like I said, it's a really exciting time, I think, to be a farmer who has the ability to make some of these choices because there's such a wide openness of the market to accept these new and interesting flavors that are coming about because of small changes in processing styles.
Mm. You think there is quite some dynamic also that happened in the last years with this anaerobic fermentation, carbonic maceration and things. So when you go to a coffee festival and you go to cupping tables, then usually I would say about 1/3 of the coffees, sometimes even more, are these funky fermentation types. So what is a bit your opinion on that? Or where do you see that, where is kind of the industry heading to?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's definitely, you know, the flavor of the month at the moment in terms of like what the darlings of new wave specialty roasters are interested in trying to work with. And I think that producers that have, again, the infrastructure to be able to take it on is are also excited about it. I've had, you know, I've experienced the full spectrum of anaerobic and carbonic style coffees where you have these incredibly funky, like over the top, wine-like, super fruity, you know, overly sweet flavors, and into, you know, potentially fermentation error territory where they become kind of sour and vinegar-like. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you know, we're working right now, one of our pour over options at the cafe behind me is a double fermented anaerobic Ecuador that's processed in the style of a washed coffee by the time it's finished. And the coffee tastes just like a grade one washed Ethiopia. It's floral, it's tropical, it's sweet, it's really elegant, it's incredibly clean. So, you know, ultimately what the anaerobic style of fermentation is offering, I think, is a way to enhance or change flavor profiles based on, you know, fermentation length and the fermenting microbes. So by reducing the oxygen and trying to eliminate it in the fermentation chamber, you limit the population of bacteria and yeast that are able to operate, right? It's mostly like lactic acid type bacteria, which might be the primary fermenting agent, although there's a whole bunch of other, you know, bacteria in the mix. They survive really well without oxygen, but many yeasts do not. And so you're basically removing a whole subsection of microbes from the equation. And then because of that, because it's essentially a cleaner style of fermentation where there's less competition amongst microbe populations, you're then able to like extend your fermentation timeframe with a lower risk of, you know, ruining the coffee essentially.
Hmm. And also, I think that the stronger these kind of fermentations are happening, the more the origin of the taste, or let's say the terroir, is a bit being pushed back. Do I get it right? Or where? What is the role of the, let's call it terroir, of the bean, where they're coming from? I mean, because at the end, people are really, they still have an idea in their head when they're talking about Ethiopians or Guatemalans or Brazilian coffees.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that there is definitely, okay, so, you know, my history working with Intelligentsia at the time between 2006 and 2016, we worked almost exclusively with washed coffees. And there was this real emphasis on the idea that, you know, washed coffee equals the, you know, clarity of terroir, and natural coffees are all just homogeneously fruity and taste all exactly the same. And the fact of the matter is that you can't say that anymore. You know, you taste these, whether it's natural or honey or some kind of, you know, alternative hybrid, you know, low oxygen processing method, whatever it is, there's countries of origin that are producing incredibly unique and delicious coffees in these ways. If you are trying to taste very specific, you know, ideas of what the terroir is, maybe it's the cultivar of the plant or a particular influence of local elevation and soil type, I think that there is probably still an argument that minimally invasive processing is going to be better at showcasing that, but that obviously is not the full spectrum of what coffee has to offer. And I think that there's a, you know, I hesitate to draw a line about what's right and wrong or what's good and bad when it comes to that, because I think that these innovations are opportunities as opposed to being sort of some sort of like falling off of the intention of what coffee is supposed to be. There's no roadmap for what coffee is supposed to be. There's just an open-ended question, like what could it be? And so there's nothing wrong with, you know, limiting as a roaster your menu because you want to present a particular brand type or a particular style because your customers prefer a particular style, whether that's, you know, washed coffees or not. But I think it's important for us not to confuse branding, marketing preference for, you know, to not prescribe what should and shouldn't be happening. I'll end this statement with a word of caution that I do think that because of how new these technologies are and because how much has been borrowed from other industries without really examining chemically, biologically, why this stuff is being used, that I think that there is a high level of risk. And so I think as a roaster, if you are asking a producer to try something new, to try something innovative with infrastructure that they may not have in place, with equipment that they don't have, and potentially risking, you know, a coffee that comes out not tasting the way it's intended, that you go in and share that risk with the producer, because you're asking more than is fair, I think, as a coffee buyer. That's my two cents on that topic. Mm-hmm.
This is only possible when you then have long-term relationships with the producer. That's probably because otherwise the risk would be too high for the producer, isn't it?
Yeah, I do think of specialty as very relationship-driven, you know, and I think that those kinds of experiments can help to build those bonds between, you know, ourselves and the coffee processor. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of processors out there who were also, I mean, it's the same trend that we saw with Geshas, you know, 10 years ago or so, where a couple folks did it, made a lot of money. And so now it's all of a sudden it's everywhere. And so I just, you know, I just urge caution, because I think that there are good things that can come of it, but flooding the market is probably not the best practice.
Mm. Yeah, mentioning geisha is a topic that I would like to come back to, or more generally talking about the varietals or the cultivars also. So what is their influence on the taste? Is it more like, because there is of course a relation between the coffee the producers choose in order to have more like, I think probably practical topics like how they can pick them, how safe it is, or how high the risk is of coffee rust. But is there also a taste influence, or what's the influence of the varietal in that?
Yeah, there's always an influence of flavor, I think, on the tree type that's being planted and worked with. It's because there is so much that goes into it, and because processing does play such an incredibly important role. I think it's easy for us to, for, easy for those nuanced flavors of cultivar to be kind of, you know, washed out a little bit by other elements that might be influencing flavor, but it's always there. I mean, Geshe would be one of the prime examples of a cultivar that has an incredibly specific flavor type. Now, over the past decade, we've seen this cultivar planted in just about every major producing country in the world. And I think that experienced cuppers will tell you that it doesn't grow the same in all conditions. It doesn't taste the same in all growing locations. And, you know, since then, we've also discovered that Geshe is, you know, a multi-pronged cultivar with at least, you know, I mean, the Peterson farm itself has at least three primary genotypes. And so there's a lack of real stability. There's also multiple Geshe populations, you know, seed banks, essentially. So not all Geshes are from the same genetic strain, which is very interesting. So it becomes a very complicated conversation. And because cultivar for so long, you know, in the historic distribution of Arabica, there's Bourbon and Typica. And basically these two trees that came from tiny little mother populations in, you know, what's modern day Yemen, and before that, Ethiopia, basically populated the entire colonized world with coffee. And the genetic monolith that is Arabica coffee is unparalleled in like plant cultivation. It's just one of the least genetically diverse plant crops on the planet. And so we have this high probability of, you know, mutation and, you know, hybridization with Arabica's tetraploid genome. It just makes things very, very complex. And so trying to nail down exactly what the taste of legacy Bourbon cultivar flavor might be is kind of a question that is not possible to fully tackle. That being said, I mean, I think that there's always an important conversation to be had around the flavor of cultivar, because I think that as we saw when Colombia first released the Castillo cultivar, there were a lot of questions about whether or not it was going to hold up to the legacy Arabica strains. And, you know, early iterations, there was a lot of discussion, at least around the people that I was talking with at the time, that it wasn't as good. And I think that we've seen that with using a combination of good farming practices, cultivar types that are targeted specifically at micro regions, and good processing methods, Castillo can achieve excellent cup scores. It's just a matter of adaptability, both on the on the terms of the plant and on the terms of the people that care for it.
Right. So then maybe we might go into something that is more practical or more easy to follow, which is kind of the screen size, because the screen size is kind of one of the main quality indicators, and also one thing that you communicate with each coffee that you're kind of trading. What is actually the influence on screen size on the quality of a coffee?
Right. Historically, larger screen sizes were typically associated with higher quality coffees. And the thought was that, you know, higher elevations were producing more dense fruit and bigger size beans. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's plenty of exceptions to that rule. If you look at a place like Ethiopia in the south, the Yirgacheffe or Sidama, the bean size there is incredibly small by comparison to much of the rest of the world. And yet I think it would be hard to argue that an excellent grade one Yirgacheffe is not close to the best coffee you can possibly get from any place in the world. So that's an immediate proof that like screen size is not everything. I think of screen size as a matter of consistency. If the coffee is well graded, it should have a narrow range of screen sizes, and that makes my job easier as a roaster. You know, heat absorption in the roasting machine directly relates to surface area and density and volume. And if there's a wide variation on the amount of surface area due to different bean sizes, then my job gets more complicated as a roaster, right? Mm-hmm. Not impossible, just something that I have to work with. I guess the other thing that historically screen size is often associated with would be price. You look at Kenya, for example, prime example of this, where double A's and AB's that might have been, you know, harvested together, processed together, and then finally separated, you know, days later, weeks later at the dry mill, and maybe taste almost identical on a blind table, are going to be, you know, valued differently by the market based on solely their screen size.
Interesting. So in fact, the screen size itself doesn't have too much of an influence. It's more the important thing is to have more or less consistent batch of sizes in order not to have too many under or over developed beans in your roast.
Yeah, I think that's the primary thing for me to focus on. And then, you know, secondarily, yeah, there is, you know, oversized beans and undersized beans have some inherent problems. Oversized beans get really roasty really quickly and maybe don't have the nutritional density to make them as excellent of a coffee. And super tiny beans almost certainly, you know, are, if they're inconsistent with the rest of the batch, are probably underripe. So definitely some quality issues possible there. There's a experiment in the book that I think I outlined some steps that you can take to like isolate and reproduce stuff that I've been doing for a while out here. And the basic principle is like, what happens if we toss some coffee into the roaster after it's been sorted into individual screen sizes and how does it taste? And I usually find that coffee on the middle to high, you know, screen size end of the spectrum tends to taste a little bit better, but it's not a universal truth necessarily.
Okay, interesting. And so now, assuming you have two batches which are more or less consistent within their sizes, but one is a coffee with really small screen size, one has a larger screen size. Do I need to roast them differently? Is there a different approach on roasting smaller or larger beans?
Probably. And it depends on other factors that I assume we're probably going to talk to in a few minutes here. But yeah, typically smaller beans, because they have a higher density, may require more heat energy than larger beans. That would be like a general, you know, observational best practice. You're going to have to take care with either situation. And if they're sorted homogeneously, then you're in pretty good shape to begin with. You should be able to observe things like color change and first crack without a whole lot of impediment to that. If you've got a wide range of screen sizes in a single batch, then you've got coffee that's turning color sooner than others and coffee that's reaching first crack sooner than others. And, you know, really for me, that's about, I think less about heat energy for a coffee like that and more about time in the roaster. If I need a homogenous looking roast, I'm really going to stretch out, especially the center stage of roasting, the Maillard reactions where color change is happening. That's like, for me, that's where all the exciting stuff is happening in the roast. And so if I play with my time during Maillard reactions as a roaster, that's where I have the most creative control, I feel like.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's actually then the phase you are focusing most of when it comes to roasting coffee, the Maillard phase.
I do. Yeah, I think because I know it's a fixed temperature and I'm kind of a time guy when I roast. I think about time and phases and time at the end of the roast, time after crack, how long it takes me to get to color change, all these different time, questions that I have in my brain. And the beautiful thing about the Maillard reactions is that they almost always begin at around 300 Fahrenheit or about 160, 165 Celsius on your beam thermocouple. And they almost always end at around 385. And I forget, what is it, 175 in Celsius, I think?
Something like 190.
Okay. So depending on your roaster type, but most coffees within a small degree variance are going to more or less be fixed at those two points in the roast. And so the variable that you as the roaster have to play with during that particular phase of roasting is time. And I think that's so liberating in a way, because that's the only thing I have to think about. And if I know that longer Maillard reactions result in certain flavor compounds like melanoidins that increase body and caramelization flavors, and if I know that by shortening the Maillard reaction that I can increase things like perceptible, you know, sensory acidity and possibly even sweetness, then those general guiding principles allow me a lot of fluidity and creativity as a roaster.
Oh, interesting. I would like to stick a bit on that because this is kind of a very interesting conversation. So, I mean, the Maillard phase then is probably ending with the beginning of first crack. But where do you set the beginning of Maillard? So how do you define then in practical roasting the Maillard phase? Because right, there's kind of this yellowing point that Rob once mentioned, but it's a bit difficult because it's just a visual indication.
Right. That's a great point. And, you know, strictly speaking, Maillard reactions continue after first crack begins and well on, you know, beyond. But when to mark first crack as a roaster is, you know, for me, it's largely just about consistency for myself to some degree. And I think that if you can be consistent as a roaster with your own methods, then you can take these principles and translate them, even if we don't agree. If you, you know, if you feel like Maillard reactions begin at 330 and I say no, they begin at 300, then neither one of us is right or wrong. It's just about observational consistency. Now, you know, we know science tells us that Maillard reactions typically begin before we can see them. And so very likely, well before most roasters are marking visible color change, which usually happens close to 300 degrees Fahrenheit on the bean probe, Maillard reactions have already begun. So for me, technically speaking, it's an arbitrary marker, but for me, it's also about consistency. And so I'm looking for homogeneous yellowing, basically, to mark color change. And that usually happens for me right around 300.
And what you change is burner setting or airflow? What are the, what are you playing around with?
That's a great question. It's both as often as I can. There's actually Roast Magazine has an article coming out at the end of the year that's got some airflow experiments that I ran and some takeaways on that. But you know, manufacturer recommended settings usually on something like a Diedrich machine would be to begin opening your airflow at Maillard reactions. And part of that's practical. You know, around the time we observe color change, there's also often some chaff coming off the beans, and you want to get that chaff out of the chamber before risking a fire. On a machine where I have some options, like in Akawa, for example, I might actually lower my fan speed during Maillard reactions because I feel like conductivity during that phase is an important part of developing interesting flavor profiles. Typically speaking, by the time we're entering color change, I will have wanted to pour most of my energy into the roasting system before that point on a traditional drum roaster. You think of, you know, maybe a Loring, for example, with that super fast turnaround point, and you're really, you know, pushing that roaster to the upper limits in some cases with a lot of heat energy. And then Maillard reactions is the opportunity as the roaster to slow down and to begin to really control the energy that you've been pouring into it in the first stage of roasting. That's my perspective on that, I guess.
Okay, interesting. We've been, so coming back to the beans, we've been scratching the topic a bit, but like one important factor is also the density. What is your, based on your experience or also based on your knowledge, what is the relation between the density and the quality of the bean?
Yeah, my understanding of this metric continues to evolve, but I do think it's a really important one. Green coffee density, you know, basically tells us how much stuff that's coffee is packed into each individual bean, and then also how those beans fall into a given physical space. And you think of all the physical spaces that coffee occupies throughout its journey, whether it's a jute bag or a roasting chamber, and it's like that matters a lot. If you have a low density coffee, it takes up more space to get the same weight. If you have a dense coffee in the roaster, most roasters are observationally aware that those types of coffees require more heat energy, particularly early in the roast. That's just something that we kind of knew a little bit. And then by taking a couple of simple measurements and making some over time observations, I feel like I've been able to create a theory around those types of coffees. And basically my general principle is that for high density coffees, I want to use a relatively hot charge temperature. And I also typically find that they perform well using quicker color change phase, whereas low density coffees need to be treated a little bit more gently. They prefer lower charge temperatures and longer Maillard reactions. It's not necessarily universal. And I think that low density coffees probably benefit from this technique more than high density ones do, which is to say that if you were to take a high density coffee and roast it in both of these styles, you would notice fewer flavor changes than if you were to do the same thing with a low density coffee. But I do think that it tells you quite a bit about coffee's value, about a coffee's ability to, you know, react to heat in the roaster. And it's also like one of the simplest measurements to take without any sort of fancy equipment. You don't have to spend a lot of money to measure density and just observe, you know, those trends over time as a green coffee buyer and as a roaster. And I think that you'll find that it's a very useful metric.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned something important, like the question on what can I actually measure? Because I mean, not everybody that's watching here has a lot of money, has the possibility like a professional lab. Some of them are smaller roasteries, some of them are even home roasters. So is there kind of, could you say that there are some measurements that are really important for any roaster to measure, like for example, the density, and what kind of equipment or lab equipment would you recommend to also to a roastery which has probably not too many funds for investing in lab equipment? So what are kind of the most important things they need to evaluate the greens?
Yeah, I mean, I guess other than looking for severe physical defects, density is the least expensive thing that you can do. All you need is like a glass or a cup. You don't even need a graduated cylinder, and you just need to know the volume of that vessel and then consistently measure the weight of coffee that fits in it. And that can be accomplished just using, you know, a glass and a scale. I believe that moisture content and water activity are extremely relevant for things like product safety and shelf life, which are two major concerns. I think that a roaster of a certain size should begin to think about investing in real lab equipment for. In my experience, my preferred moisture meter is the Cynar Bean Pro. I think that it is a top-notch machine. It also has the secondary advantage of measuring density for you. But it's consistent and it's accurate, and I just haven't found its equal on the market. Water activity is probably not something that every roaster needs to be measuring. And the equipment is expensive, but I would say probably your importer is measuring it. And if they're a transparent enough importer, they should probably be sharing that information with you if you ask for it. If you're concerned about a coffee's shelf life or a coffee's, you know, perhaps volatile environmental experience during shipping, water activity can often tell you a little bit about how that coffee's been handled during the process.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Can you go a bit into water activity? I think water content we've been talking about is probably quite easy to understand. It's kind of the amount of water in a bean, the mass of a bean. But what is actually water activity, and how do I measure water activity?
Right. Water activity is water vapor pressure. So it's like, how badly does the water that's trapped in the coffee want to escape? And we measure that using most prosumer level equipment is basically the same technology as the moisture meters, where it's a capacitance measurement. It's just done over time. The primary like scientific benchtop machine would probably be using a chilled mirror, which also takes time to observe. It's just a more accurate reference point. In either case, it's basically about changes in vapor pressure over time. One of the reasons this is extremely important is because ever since about the 1950s, food science has used water activity as their primary metric for product safety. It's more accurate in predicting whether or not, you know, things like fungus or mold might grow on your food products, and coffee is included in this. You know, coffee not only has the sensory defect potential for mold, but also, if it's not been dried properly, it could also grow new mold, which is, you know, a safety hazard. So for that reason, water activity is extremely important, although it would take a pretty severely problematic coffee to, you know, be dangerous like that. The next most important thing that it tells us is if water vapor pressure is trying to escape pretty hard from coffee, if there's a decent amount of water content in the green coffee, and it's exerting a lot of pressure to escape. It's also taking, you know, flavor compounds with it in most cases. And basically what that means is that that coffee might have an accelerated aging process. And if you're trying to avoid flavors like papery woody in your, you know, delicate floral Ethiopian or your juice bomb natural, then water activity is going to tell you a lot about how long that coffee will continue to taste great before it starts to fade.
So when it comes to this, like water activity, water content, density of the roast, is there also something like some practical guidelines that you can give a roaster when it comes to roasting the beans? Are the different styles of roasting needed for different water activity, or is it really more about storage of the beans that it's relevant for?
You know, the primary concern is safety and storage. There is possibly some evidence that Maillard reactions may be accelerated by higher water activities and moisture contents. Maillard reactions require a little bit of moisture to begin, basically. It's possible that high water activity coffees might exhibit color change more quickly as a result. And so if you're measuring something that's, you know, high on the water activity spectrum, you should just exercise some additional caution at the end of the roast to make sure that you don't overshoot or undershoot your color target. I think that there's a misconception that I've, you know, probably been guilty at points of time in my career of perpetuating, which is that by first crack, there's almost no moisture remaining in the coffee, and that's not true. I've seen some recent studies by folks here at University of California in Davis, and there's, you know, upwards of possibly, you know, 5 to 6% moisture content at first crack still, which is quite a lot, depending on how much we started with, you know. So keeping in mind that the moisture question is going to be a constant as you're roasting coffee. You're driving it off, but it's also, you know, a part of the density quadrant. Is there more water to coffee solids? Coffee solids are more dense than water, and as a result, you know, more damp coffees tend to be lower in density. And all these things relate to how coffee handles heat. My experience is often that the early stage of roasting, before we achieve color change, can be a pretty important determining factor, particularly for either low density or high moisture coffees, where taking it gently and slow through that early phase tends to present you with better opportunities for successful roasts using that kind of like lower heat energy approach.
Yeah. Okay, interesting.
I'm giving away all the secrets here.
It is good. It's fine for you, because I think people are just after secrets. And one secret we could talk about. But something that that is really difficult for many people, and you are really experienced in, is trading coffee. And I think one beautiful dynamic that we have now within the coffee industry is that more and more people want to establish direct relation to the producers and want to do direct trade and want to source the coffee fairly in order then to also source it sustainably, but also give back to the producing people. And since you're quite experienced in trading and also directly trading coffees, can you go a bit into that? So what, when it comes to directly trading a coffee from a producer, what are the most important things to look at? What are kind of the challenges, or what are the steps that a roastery would have to look at? Or are there also other ways, probably better for a roastery than to directly source it? Are there also alternatives around? Maybe you can go a bit into that topic of trading the coffee.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that you know, working directly with farmers is often seen as a way to improve relationships and guarantee fair payment. And I think that probably scale, you know, just sheer volume of trade is maybe one of the biggest inhibitors to successful direct contact, because if you're a roaster who can only commit to 5 or 10 bags from a producer who's able to supply, you know, 500 or 600 bags to the market, then that producer is probably less likely to be interested in taking a lot of very specific direction for a very small portion of their harvest. I think that importers are also, you know, hesitant in some cases to do complicated container consolidations for direct trade imports. If you've got, you know, 50 different roasters who each need six bags of very highly specific, you know, individually labeled coffees, that's a lot more difficult to export than a single bulk lot of a regional blend. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think that's why we all got into direct trade in the first place, was to try to be something better, right? To do something better both for the roaster and for the farmer. And I just like to think about, you know, the responsibility as a buyer, as someone who has the kind of purchasing power that I do, avoiding things like manipulation and exploitation when I go to work with producing partners, trying to meet them on their terms, acknowledging that when I travel, that's their home, and that I should ask permission for some things that I might take for granted in my home country. And when I engage in trade relationships, that it's a matter of asking them what they're capable of and what they're willing to do rather than my demands. You know, if I need a highly specific processing style or coffee done that they're not prepared to do, I should be turning to perhaps an importer or an exporter to work with who has better access to a wide range of supply networks that might be able to get that specific need for me. If I have a particular relationship that I'm pursuing, acknowledging that, you know, maybe in some cases, the pursuit of a good long-term trade relationship might occasionally mean that I have to compromise some of my quality standards. You know, it's like, which one are you gonna choose? You can't have, it's the classic like impossible triangle of coffee. You can either have traceable, you can have great coffee, or you can have cheap coffee. You can pick two of those three. You can't have all three, right?
And so now, once the coffee is here, and once I have the coffee in my roastery, completely different topic, but also a very important topic when it comes to quality. How should I actually store the coffee in order to keep them fresh?
Yeah, the same with roasted coffee. The enemies to green coffee tend to be oxygen and sunlight. Extreme temperatures. So the recommended storage conditions would be about, I'm sorry, I'm going to talk in Fahrenheit, 65 Fahrenheit, and about 65% relative humidity, which is not so different from what I, you know, get to experience almost every day here in Oakland, California. Beyond that, if you're concerned about, you know, high quality coffee that potentially could be fading, airtight containers. While I hesitate to recommend the use of more plastics, GrainPro is a proven method for preserving quality. And even if your coffee didn't ship in GrainPro, transferring it to an airtight storage as green coffee will improve its ability to last on the shelf. I think it works equally well as vacuum sealing, in my experience. And I'm certain that there are ways to do that using less disposable plastics. The conversation of freezing coffee comes up pretty frequently. Using industrial type freezers with super low temperatures, coffee can last at great quality for years, although it should probably be roasted. As soon as it's out of the freezer, within a few days, probably. And I've seen, I haven't run the experiments myself, but I've seen some very strong evidence that you can roast coffee starting it as frozen without impeding quality, which I think is very interesting.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. And probably one of our last questions is a bit on sample roasting. What's your approach that you would recommend to a roastery when it comes to sample roasting? Because I think there is, of course, the protocol by the CQI, by the SCA. But when I'm, for example, a roastery in that want to roast more this Italian, because here in Europe we have quite some roasteries that are roasting a bit darker for this Italian espresso. Does it still make sense, in your opinion, to roast according to the CQI protocol, or would you then also do sample roasting a bit darker? What's your kind of your approach on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sample roasting, I think as much as many roasters and QC agents try to think about it as if it were some sort of objective perspective on coffee, there's really no such thing. There's always the influence of the machine itself and of the style of roasting. And so I guess from my perspective, sample roasting is about, answering the question, is this coffee right for me? And about giving that coffee the opportunity to succeed at that question. Mm-hmm. The answer to those questions are going to be related in some ways to a roaster's stylistic choices. You know, we at Intelligentsia, we roasted our samples extremely light. And the idea was that we were trying to avoid any sort of roast influence at all and see strictly whether or not the green coffee was defective and what kinds of flavor potentials it has. If you think about, I'm going to get a little esoteric with this, but if you think about that old flavor wheel, the old SCA flavor wheel that has the two separate wheels, there is a couple of sections that are labeled enzymatic sugar browning and I think dry distillation, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And I like to think of breaking those old sections, the enzymatic stuff, it's like all the floral, all the green pepper, all the fruit stuff. That's the raw potential of the coffee. That's everything the producer has given you as like this potential energy. And then sugar browning is the roaster's opportunity for creation. And so if you as a roaster are, you know, working within those sugar browning types of flavors and you feel the need to evaluate your samples as a part of that spectrum to assess whether or not the coffee is going to work for you, then you should absolutely do that. I don't think that, you know, coffee is such a creative spectrum and drawing hard lines in the sand about what should and shouldn't be done, I think is, you know, other than a couple of like primary defect avoiding techniques, there's probably a lot of wiggle room for the average roaster to be creative and to get good results.
When it comes to the green coffee and the decisions on green coffee, we've been talking about processing types, green size, density. Is there any recommendation you can give a roaster when it comes then to blends? So is there what particularly do I have to consider when doing a blends? Like in particular, I'm talking about pre-blending then. I don't know, probably you're even not recommending pre-blending at all, but if a person would do pre-blending, is there anything particular they would have to have a look at?
Sure, yeah. Believe it or not, I do manage a small pre-blended green coffee for Royal out here, so I have a little bit of experience working with it. Yeah, absolutely. Physical spec similarity between different coffees on pre-blending is really important because, once again, it kind of gets to that question of how are these coffees going to be developing in the roaster. And as I think I've observed over, you know, the past, you know, decade plus, when I've been thinking about this stuff, is that, yeah, absolutely. Different densities, different moisture contents, and different screen sizes are going to impact the way coffees flavored and color develop in roasting. So when I'm looking at adding ingredients to create a pre-blended coffee, the first thing I'm always looking at is flavor profile, but the second thing is also, you know, are these coffees developing similarly and are their physical specs similar as a pre-blend? Because you have to really manage that as a roaster. I think that pre-blending offers a lot of opportunities for operational efficiency. And I think that if that's your goal, then it's a great option. I think that it creates some challenges when it comes to QC.
Well, thanks a lot. That was really interesting. Is there anything you think we didn't cover when it comes to decisions or things roasters have to look at when it comes to green coffee? Or
as much as I should be promoting the purchase of my book, there's no substitute for experience. The company of good peers. So, you know, being curious and asking questions, I think is something that I'd highly recommend for anyone that is interested in learning more about green coffee. Like, don't be shy because you don't know something. Feel free to ask someone, and then also take those answers with a grain of salt and do your own research, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think probably with green coffee, even more than anything else, just try. Go to cuppings and try different beans.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So yeah, thanks a lot for all the information for the book. When people want to know more about you or the things you are offering, where can they find about you and what also do you offer to people to learn about green coffee or roasting?
Sure. I mean, first of all, thanks for the time and opportunity here, Ingo. I really appreciate the time to say a lot of words and speak with you. It's been really fun. If you want to learn a little bit more about me, you can check out, I've got a LinkedIn and a Instagram page that are easy to find. So if you want to learn a little bit more about my perspectives on coffee, I would look first to royalcoffee.com. There's a pretty extensive blog. We also offer classes and private trainings, and you can even find an ebook online about the blending topic, which is not a part of the green coffee book. And then I'm also published in Daily Coffee News, Roast Magazine, Coffee T&I, Tea and Coffee Trade Journal. So there's plenty of opportunities for you to read more if you like.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris, for all the information you are sharing, for the information you shared in the book, in this video, but also online. And also thanks a lot for coming into that video. I really appreciate it. Yeah, thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks so much, Ingo. I really appreciate the opportunity and the time. It's been super fun speaking with you. And also appreciate that the book's going to be easily available for folks in Europe. That's a real thrill for me. I hope folks are able to take advantage of that. Thank you.